RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
A KFC tale in the pursuit of flavor. The Colonel made his $10 Tuesday bucket so full with 8 pieces of juicy, crispy chicken or tenders that it might just last you till Wednesday. If you've got that kind of self-control. I mean, some people want leftovers. Others are more into right nowers. The Colonel lived so we could chicken. $10, 8 pieces, one big deal with KFC $10 Tuesdays.
Prices and participation may vary. Taxes, tips, and fees extra.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And I don't know why I'm laughing. This episode, I did it. I'm happy I did it. Ricky Brule, from the Range Podcast, jumps on today. And here's what we talk about. We talk about the impact on certain types of hunting products throughout human history. And after I re-listened to this episode, I felt it was great. It's a great episode. But it made me want to go out and find an actual historian to talk about the impact that certain weapons had for hunting throughout the years. Like on this episode, we have two non-historians, just, you know, I guess fans of history, fans of hunting, and we just have kind of a BS session. Ultimately, that's what this episode is. It's a BS session. So we talk about spears. We talk about arrowheads. We talk about hunting strategy and how it may have evolved throughout human history. And then we talk about modern hunting, where we discuss trail cameras, where we discuss, you know, black powder rifles and muskets and things like that, that ultimately made hunting easier throughout the throughout history. And then we talk about modern day hunting as well. We talk about trail cameras. We talk about digital mapping, apps like HuntStand and Onyx and things like that, and what kind of impacts they have had on, you know, especially mature whitetails. I feel like everybody wants to go shoot a big mature buck. And I talk a little bit about my own experience where as soon as I got a trail camera, I jumped up into what type of bucks I wanted to kill instantly, the same year I got one. And I had to put in a lot of time after that in order to get close to those deer. But I knew that those types of deer existed. Therefore, I'm passing smaller bucks. And so it's a fun episode. It's a BS session. I know you guys will like it. What do we got to do now? That's what today's episode is about. Do me a favor. If you haven't already, go check out fullsneakgear.com. It is an apparel business that I just started. I got crew neck sweaters. I got the Nine Finger Chronicles hat. I got multiple t-shirts, including the brand new Slayer t-shirt. It is a black t-shirt. It was actually created by a company in the Czech Republic that designs album covers for death metal bands, believe it or not. And I just went into a rabbit hole on the internet. I said, all right, let's brainstorm some ideas. And that's where I landed. And so if you're looking for a t-shirt with a zombie deer on the front of it, you got to go check out fullsneakgear.com and buy yourself one. So there's that. On top of that, we do have to do a commercial for our paying partners, and that is Code Blue Scents. Now, first off, I've talked on the Hunting Gear podcast with Code Blue Scents, and when you hear them talk about their products, one thing stands out, and that is the quality. They are very passionate about quality, right? And just like any type of product, whether it's a car, whether it's a dishwasher, a shirt, whatever, quality is very important, right? You get what you pay for. And so it's really cool to see and hear Code Blue talk about the quality checks that they put into, or they've built into the process of the products that they manufacture, right? And especially when it comes to the one deer per bag type of, you know, per scent packet that they sell. And so that the quality you need to have that is very, very high. And so whether it's a real scent or a synthetic scent, or a scent elimination product, or my favorite, the pre-orbital rope-a-dope system that they have. It is very important to have very quality, very fresh scents, and only Code Blue can do that. So if you're looking for, whether it's real synthetic scents, a scent elimination products, the rope-a-dope mock scrape kit, please go out and go check out codebluescents.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. I, in fact, here probably in March sometime, I'm going to try to mix it in with the shed hunting that I do this year. But I'm going to say this. I'm going to be putting in a lot of time into mock scrapes this year, including the rope-a-dope mocks, you know, the rope-a-dope system. So please do me a favor, go check out codebluescents.com, go check out fullsneakgear.com, go check out sportsmansempire.com. We have a ton of great podcasts coming down the pipe every single week at the Sportsman's Empire, and it's about hunting, it's about the outdoors, it's about everything that we love about the North American hunting and fishing and conservation, everything that, you know, passionate people just sharing stories and talking about the stuff that we really love. So please go out, find a different podcast that you've never listened to before. Give it a try. And I'm, you know, they all go through a pretty rigorous vetting system. So I don't just let garbage come on the network. Go check it out. Go find a podcast on the network that you've never listened to before. Go check it out. And I'm almost positive you'll walk away with something from these podcasts. So good vibes, ladies and gentlemen. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Let's start today's podcast where two dudes who don't know anything about history talk about history. So you have a good one, and we'll talk to you when we talk to you. 3, 2, 1. All right. Welcome to another episode of the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today we are talking with another member of the Sportsman's Empire, Ricky Brule. Rick, what is going on, man?
Not much, man. I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. Did I say your last name right?
I think so.
Brule?
I think you did. Yeah, you said Brule. It right.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's what I thought. Yeah. You know, I didn't know if the E was silent or not.
Yeah, sometimes it's pretty common for people to say it, mispronounce it. And for a while there, I just kind of got used to it and just didn't say anything. And then I had people get mad at me. They're like, dude, you got to tell me what your name is. It's not cool that I've been calling you this all this time. And I'm just like so laid back with it that I just, it's all good. But you said it right.
When I was younger, I always wished my name was more complicated because there's literally nothing easier than Dan Johnson. Okay. Right. And so, you know, it's like, hey, I heard Dan Johnson was at a party, you know, when I was in high school. It's like, oh, it must have been a different Dan Johnson. Nope. If my name was like Theodore Szczesowski or something like that, right? So it's like, don't worry about it, right? Everybody forgets the people with complicated names, but definitely not me. I was easy to pick out.
Yeah, back in the day, your name was probably in contention for John Doe with an unidentified
male. Exactly. That's Dan Johnson. Dan Johnson probably did it. So,
Well, in all fairness, you're the only Dan Johnson I know. So
really?
Yeah. I know a lot of Johnsons, but no Dans.
True story. I had a check for, this was several years ago. I had a check for $3,000. Okay. Mm. And I took it to the bank. Deposited it, but it never showed up in my account. And so I had to go back to the bank. They're like, oh no, you didn't deposit any checks. We have no record of that. Well, long story short, they ended up putting it into the account of a different Dan Johnson. So in my town of back in the day, there was probably 8,000 people in my town. There were 54 Dan Johnsons that banked. There's 54 Dan Johnsons that banked at the same bank as me. And so you got to have a better system than this, right? You're a bank. You should, there's no way these types of mistakes should be happening.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we all have like a 9-digit number, right?
Oh yeah. All that stuff. I mean, all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, how'd your season go this year?
Well, relatively good, I guess. I got out a few times, but not as much as I'd like to, and that's okay. Yeah. I got to spend a week up in the Boundary Waters of Minnesota just to get away, and I didn't draw any Western tags. That was my main focus this year. Didn't draw any tags, so I just decided to go up and do some fishing and just relax and get away, and that's pretty much what I did. I just busted out the camera and just filmed and tried to be as primitive as I could, you know, trying to light fires with ferro rods and goof around and do stuff like that. It was a blast. I had a good time, but, so didn't get to hunt as much as I'd like to, but, looking forward to this next upcoming season. I should draw some tags and should be able to get out and do some running around with my bow in my hand.
Yeah. I'll say this, man. Even some of those adventures, like what you said, the Boundary Waters, I mean, it's not hunting per se. You might be able to do a little bit of fishing in some of that. I know guys who have hunted up there in the Boundary Waters on some of those islands, but just doing something like that is pretty sweet. I can remember when I was in high school and I was in Boy Scouts, we went on a 55-mile canoe trip that lasted I want to say five days. It's called the Current River down in the border between Missouri and Arkansas, somewhere in that area.
Yeah.
And it was fun, man. On a canoe. That was back then before cell phones or anything like that. So it was on a canoe, on the river, everything you needed, all your food, all your tent, all your sleeping equipment, like you said, fire starter, all that stuff in the canoe. And man, I still remember how much fun I had on that trip, man. It was so much fun.
Yeah, those are the things, those are core memories, man. You're never going to forget about that kind of stuff. So yeah, sounds like a blast.
Yeah. All right. Yesterday or last week, I was like, hey, what's an idea for the Hunting Gear podcast? And I had just finished watching some type of random YouTube video about arrowheads, right? And how Native Americans and all the, like, even in Africa and things like that, all the, like, the history of hunting, right?
Yeah.
Kind of popped into my head. So I sent you an email and said, hey, you want to hop on the podcast? And here we are. And so I don't really know where to go. We're going to call this a BS session because I don't know where to start. I don't know how, I don't know how this is going to end, but in the history of humans, let's take it back. And by the way, we are not historians. So like, if you are a historian and you're listening to this, I'd love to have you come on the podcast. But from this point of the show, it's two dudes who really love hunting, just speculating on what things could have or are, if that makes sense. Okay. So my first random question to you is, do you think that there was a time in human history where there was an object or a strategy or some type of method of hunting that resulted in an easier take of wild game, or resulted in more animals being killed?
Ooh, that's tough, and I'm really glad that you prefaced that we're not historians, because obviously this is going to be based on the knowledge or lack thereof that
exactly,
I have.
Exactly.
I'm a history buff, so I do like to dive into that kind of stuff. And you know, me and my daughter recently been watching this program on Netflix, and it's just about, you know, life and you know, survival of the fittest, you know, 2 million years ago, 72 million years, I mean, way back, right? Yeah. So it's really interesting. But in any case, I don't know. Like, I got all kinds of things going through my head. I'm thinking, like, you know, trapping. That was one that didn't really cross my mind immediately, but then I was thinking about, you know, like the old net, you know, that something walks into and boom, you know, catches them that way. Cause you know, I think about some of the most elusive critters, in modern times. Right. So, like wolves, for example, are not easy to hunt. They're very, very elusive. And, hopefully I don't get some people fired up about this, cause the, you know, it's a hot, kind of a hot button issue, but, like in Minnesota, when we first had a season here, which, well, in a long time since they delisted, this was, gosh, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago or something like that, we had a season. And I would say probably, well, I probably shouldn't throw out percentages or figures, but I would definitely say a majority of those wolves were taken via trapping.
Okay.
Just simply because they're so elusive. And, you know, snare trapping, I think, was one of the more common ways of doing it. And it's kind of a passive way of doing it too. You know what I mean? You don't have to put a lot of energy in it, set a bunch of traps and step away and then come check them on a daily basis. So I would like to think that that would be probably one of the methods, you know, in a more primitive time that perhaps had the most success. But I also don't do a lot of trapping myself. So I figured it'd be best for me to explain it in that way. The other thing I guess I think about is, you know, probably some sort of strategy, right? So you get groups of individuals together and you kind of start to figure out how animals work, and then you work together as a team. And I feel like that would be a good method. But speaking more specifically about weaponry, boy, back in the early days, I got to say it was probably a spear, something like that. Yeah. You know, I imagine that was probably invented prior to the bow and arrow.
Yeah.
So I guess that's where I'd go with that.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, and that's crazy that we're having a conversation about hunting gear and equipment that happened before, like, recorded history, right? And so,
yeah.
And so I would think that the groups of people had, so, you know, like, there was a time when humans didn't have weren't using probably tools. I mean, even primates, monkeys, use tools, right? Like, rocks to smash each other's heads, or throwing stuff, or even the primates that, you know, they lick the straw, the piece of grass, and they dip it into the ant hole, right? So, and then they eat the ants off the stick, right? And so those are all different types of tools that primates have used. But then as our brain evolved and we stepped away from primates, I guess you would say, the strategy and style became more complex in how we acquired meat. And so I think, you know, like wolves, right? They work as a team almost all the time. Like you rarely hear a story about a wolf going out by itself, right? Unless it's, you know, they're working as a team. So I would think that, and this is one thing that I found very interesting, is like these early humans would group together and then they would push buffalo or wild game off of a cliff, and then they'd all fall to their death. And then that's how, so that strategy worked very well. You corral them in, you push them up into a high spot, and you scare the shit out of them over the edge. And that's how, so that's from a strategy standpoint. But I wonder, you know, I found a couple arrowheads in my life. I wonder when the spear sharpened from a straight stick actually went to a spear with an arrowhead on it, or a spear tip on it, how that would have worked. Because my assumption is now you have FOC up front, there's generating more momentum, and potentially, depending on what your spear looked like, the stability of it potentially got stiffer, thus you're more accurate with your throw. You can practice and become more accurate. So I wonder if there was an uptick in accuracy of killing game when they added a stone tip to those spears.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, you could apply it to, you know, even your modern day setup, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to use a field point to, you know, shoot a deer or shoot an animal. I mean, you could, and if you were accurate, it would function. It would probably work. But, you know, just knowing that having a broadhead of some sort on there is most certainly going to increase your chances, especially in a situation where you might not be as accurate, you know, you know, some of the cutting diameters on some of these heads is just getting silly, right? But again, and some of the ones that have these giant cuts, like me and some buddies, we kind of joke about them. We call them the best bad shot broadheads, because you can get away with, you know, maybe being a little bit off and still, you know, maybe, you know, graze the, you know, the aorta on the heart, or, you know, just catch something where you may have not had a lethal shot, you know, just again trying to create as much hemorrhaging as possible in order to make sure that animal goes down. So without a doubt, I think you're right there. Most certainly helped a ton.
Yeah. This is the fascinating part of these conversations, is the first, like the first person, right? Imagine a guy sitting around a fire that he built, and he's got his spear and he's just wasting time, right? He's not on a hunt. He's not doing anything around his camp. He's just sitting, maybe warming up. He looks down at a rock, or he throws a rock and it chips another rock and it makes a sharp. And he is that first person in human history to go, I'm going to put this rock on my spear and I'm going to see what happens to it. Right. And then how he would then communicate that to other people in his group or tribe or whatever it was. And so those are the types of things where it's like the first person to ever create artificial fire, right? By slamming two rocks mm-hmm. together, right? It's just those types of moments have this gigantic impact in human history moving forward, because without mm-hmm. fire, you know, we don't have this fake heat and we have to be more nomadic throughout the year mm-hmm. and go travel south and things like that. So it's crazy. Like those types of moments by, you know, like, oh, I'm the first guy to ever put an arrowhead on us or even attempt to make one. And as someone is watching him, they come up and go, well, try this. And then that works. And now this yeah. guy and this guy are working together to try. I don't know. I'm a kind of a nerd on things like that. And I just really think that if I could be a fly on a wall, it'd be moments like that. I would love to go back in human history and just be a fly on the wall and watch that all go yeah. down. So,
yeah, I mean, you have to wonder if a guy was, you know, if they were just, I don't know what, you know, just kicking it or, yeah. you know, goofing around and throwing rocks, or maybe that's what happened. Maybe, yeah. you know, because that might've been one of the most primitive weapons of its time, and, you know, just throwing rocks around and created a spark and lit a piece of grass oh, yeah. on fire. Everybody looked at each other wide-eyed, like, what the heck? Okay. And then start goofing around, you know, and start. And what even boggles my mind even more is to think about having the sheer amount of time that you would be able to have to just, like, experiment and play
oh,
around
yeah.
with things, right?
Can absolutely.
You imagine just being, you know, if you don't be bored out of your mind, you know, otherwise. So you're just experimenting and playing and constantly trying to improve and then how even that sort of technology just expands amongst people through word yeah. of mouth and, oh, look at this, check this out, you know, between tribes. And yeah, yeah, that blows my mind too.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause eventually what is happening is throughout human history, you're seeing methods, and we could even argue that it's still happening in today's hunting, where everything makes hunting easier. Back mm-hmm. then it had carried more weight because we didn't have grocery stores, right? We had to hunt meat and we had, you know, for our basic survival. And now it's taken on a completely different role, but it's still everything in human history is kind of focused on making hunting easier. I wonder what were some of the first weapons that they had, like, you know, the spear, obviously. I wonder if once archery became a thing and they were making, you know, projectiles now, that for like a bow or a spear is probably, if I'm going to guess, a spear is probably one of the first, outside of a rock, a spear yeah. is probably one of the first weapons. And then from that came some kind of other projectile, like an atlatl or the, you know, a traditional archery, you know, a bow made out of a stick and some intestines or things like that. And they're launching yeah. arrows and things like that. And I always think about, you know, once the bow and arrow were invented, if that was more efficient than a spear or any other type of, you know, throwing a rock or things like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I think I suppose spears probably maybe got, you know, smaller and thinner as they, you know, honed in the technology or whatever back then. But most certainly, I mean, even if you think back to, you know, wartime stuff, mm-hmm. If you had an army that didn't have archers, you probably weren't going to win that battle.
Yeah.
You know, just having that long distance advantage, I think was tremendous.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, without a doubt, having the projectile and, you know, and then just continuously fine tuning it. I mean, think about the gigantic crossbows they had mm-hmm. that they would shoot these giant spears at people, you know, stuff like that. And maybe that didn't really happen. Maybe I'm just thinking of like Lord of the Rings or something like that. And they were just trying to shoot giant ogres. I have no idea. But, you know, it's just most certainly, you know, some type of a projectile probably moved that
yeah
pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. And now we fast forward, you know, there's all these different weapons, and now we fast forward to, I don't even know if I would call this modern day, but the introduction of black powder and muskets, or using black powder to, you know, in the first modern day gun, and you can even fast forward that into the first modern day rifle. Right. And I'm assuming that once the gun, once the rifle or even the musket was invented, then there was even a greater step up in acquiring meat for, I mean, it had to have been easier.
Mm-hmm. Oh, guaranteed. I mean, and some historians may correct me on this. I believe it was the 4570 that almost single-handedly, you know, took out the bison, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that wasn't even for the meat. That was just for, and again, this is based on my knowledge. I have a few friends that would be able to verify this. Can I phone a friend real quick? but I believe it was mostly just for the leather.
Yes.
Because it was during the Industrial Revolution, or just before the Industrial Revolution, or during it, they needed the leather to create, make belts to run some of the machines. And I think that's where a majority of all of those kills went.
And there was a huge fashion craze in Europe for buffalo fur.
Yep, absolutely. That makes sense too, for sure.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, you just think about that, you know, that rifle, you know, and who's to say, you know, if the Native Americans were so inclined, they probably could have wiped out the species with bow and arrow as well, but they were just more mindful of the fact that it just doesn't make sense to do that, right? It's for sustainability reasons.
Exactly. And so, you know, obviously, I mean, even modern day, right? If my goal is to acquire meat based off of the survival of my species or of my family, I'm taking a gun out into the woods over a bow, over whatever the case may be, right? So obviously, from when we talk about efficiency, well, hey, I tell you what, let's do something fun here. Let's talk about, try to put them in order. What weapon, highest to lowest, is the greatest efficiency to put meat in the freezer? You know, I think we can both agree that a rifle is number one on the top of the list, right? What's number two?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but rifle. Definitely. I mean, just like you said, my hunting now is limited. And so if I go turkey hunting, I always start with the shotgun.
Yep.
Now I used to be really like diehard, like I'm never going to use a shotgun. I'm always going to do it with a bow. And now it's like, you know, my opportunities at getting out and turkey hunting are much more reliant upon me bringing home some meat.
Yep.
And if I don't do that, then those opportunities get fewer and fewer. So yeah, definitely. Definitely the gun. Boy, number two. Oof. Man, again, I would almost have to say, you know, it's certainly a skill that needs to be honed over time, but I think anybody who is really proficient and good at trapping, I think, is probably number two.
Yeah.
Because again, you don't have to rely on the skills of stalking. You don't have to rely on all of that kind of stuff. You just have to set traps and let them do the work.
Yeah. And I would say that is hunting 24 hours a day, right? You're hunting even though you can't, you're not hunting, right? So you have a system of take out there that's working for you 24 hours if you're good at it.
Yeah.
If you're good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this day and age, I don't know that trapping is used as much for meat as it is probably for hides and for other things. But again, if we're talking about strict survival and it, you know, you eat whatever you can trap, then I think that's number two.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So after that, then, my guess is crossbow. If we go firearms, we go trapping, and then crossbow would be more efficient, easier to acquire meat with than archery equipment.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I have to agree with you on that one.
Ah, bummer.
And that's a whole nother story. We won't even get into that.
Yeah.
That's,
so that's this, so we'll just edit out the part where we make fun of people who shoot crossbows. I'm just joking, guys. It's a joke.
Yeah.
Okay. Because some people can get pretty butthurt.
My day kicks off with a refreshing Celsius energy drink. Then straight to the gym. Pre-K pickup, back home to meal prep. Time for my fire station shift. One more Celsius, gotta keep the lights on. When the 3-alarm hits, I'm ready. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So archery equipment and then obviously trad, right? I know there are some states that do allow you to hunt with spears and atlatls, right? And things and things like that. And I'm sure in every situation, right, in every environment, there is probably a method of take that is better. Like in the wide open, a rifle would be the best bet. But if you're hunting elk in black timber, a bow might be just as beneficial than a rifle if you're accurate with a bow. Number one, you're going to get in tight. And number two, if you miss, you're not going to scare the animals away. So, I don't know, is what it is.
Yeah. I can agree with that. Yeah. And then I was thinking about something too, as you were talking, but we might have to, maybe this is too ridiculous to even count, but we may have to take everything and shift it down a notch, because what about rifles from helicopters? I think that's number one.
Just imagine, dude, I wouldn't be surprised. Right. So obviously they have those guys who are shooting like damn near automatic rifles out of helicopters when hunting pigs. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not, you talk about, oh, it would be crazy to hunt elk or deer with a rifle from a helicopter. But I bet you it's not that far out of the world we live in that someone is going to be like, hey, listen, I would like to introduce helicopter hunting with a machine gun, for elk, right? Or deer or something like that. It would blow people's mind. Then it would get voted in, and then 30 years would go by and people would be like, oh, I've been hunting from a helicopter with an automatic rifle for 30 years now. Right? You know, don't take that away from me. Right? it's nuts. It's nuts. Okay. Mm-hmm. I want to shift now to what we would call modern day hunting. And that would be when we no longer need to rely on our hunting skills to get us meat. Right, we could be shitty hunters if we don't get our meat. Well, hell, let's go to the grocery store and get our food. Okay. And we've already really talked about that in some way. I mean, it's not all the weapons are going to talk about. You know, we're going to talk about efficiency, and really, you can get it done with just about any method these days. Tree stand, right? That's something that I would like to talk about a second. Do you think that once hunters left the ground and started hunting in trees, they became, and I'm sure it's not like what we know today where they had a hang on tree stand back in the day, right? But second that they left the ground and perched themselves in trees, do you think that had a bigger impact in success rates of hunting?
Yeah, I think it did, and it might have had an impact on the mortality rate of the hunters as well. I mean, if you're just climbing a tree and sitting on a branch, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I think about times where I've shot deer sitting in a tree, and the feeling you get afterwards. If I wasn't tethered to that tree, man, I'd be on the ground with a broken ankle. You know, yep. So you just get jazzed up and just excited. But yeah, definitely, you know, just being able to get your scent up and off the ground, you know, I think that gives you somewhat of an advantage. And, you know, again, just being able to get away with a little bit more movement, not having to focus so much on, like here in Minnesota, if you're going to hunt from the ground, that movement is really tough. And even if you have a ground blind or something and you haven't had it set up for a long time and it's brushed in really good, deer really pick them out pretty good, and they get pretty spooky. Unless, of course, it's turkey season, then they don't seem to care. But if they know it's hunting season, they're like, what is that thing? And they just bail out of there. So certainly getting up in a tree was a major advancement in hunting, for sure.
I mean, at one point, tree stands were illegal in Iowa. I know they were in Iowa.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you could not use a tree stand when you started hunting. And I think I even heard a guy in Michigan say that. At one point, tree stands were illegal in several states once they started coming out, because they thought it was such a huge advantage to the deer. I mean, just imagine being the first guy ever to walk into a piece of public or on a piece of property with a tree stand and watching the deer, my guess is, have no clue what's going on. Even if they smelled you, they're like, wait, I can see in front of me, there's no threat there. Where's this threat coming from? Right. I bet you that would definitely be something to see. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
The next thing, modern hunting, right? And I want to talk about mature bucks, right? Because that's what in this hunting industry, everybody wants big, giant antlered whitetails, right?
Yep.
What do you think from the modern hunting era, what do you think resulted in one of the, what product or piece of hunting gear and equipment, maybe even a strategy, that was the most effective for killing a mature big antlered whitetail?
Well, I think on a more general scope, I think technology has probably been a major part of that. And then more specifically, probably trail cameras.
Yeah.
And then even, you know, I was going to say drones, but that probably came and went so quickly as far as them becoming legal that I don't know that too many people had opportunities to do that. But most certainly, I mean, you think back to even, you know, back when there was just event timers, right? Like you would just run a little string across a trail. And then if something would trigger the string, it's like, then you would go, oh, I knew something was here at some point. Right. And so now you can hone in on a specific area because you know something's moving through there at a specific time, right? Like you can see there's a deer trail there, but you don't know if it's at night or not. But now you're like, ooh, I'm seeing some daytime movement. You know, of course that takes a lot more work and, you know, you're leaving your scent and all that kind of stuff. And now you can set a trail camera and never have to set foot in there. And you can see all the photos. And me personally, I think it's great. I think it adds a little bit more excitement to the sport. I think it brings a lot of people in. And part of the reason I say that is I just recorded a podcast with a friend of mine just last week, and he's an adult onset hunter. He's only been hunting for 5 years, but where he gets excited is seeing the pictures. Like he's seen all the pictures of the deer and he's just jacked up and he's like ready to get out and can't wait to get out and share, you know, he's like the social community that it creates where you're sharing the photos with your buddies and you're all getting excited and getting pumped up. And so, but yeah, I would definitely say it has to be technology for sure.
Yeah. And I can agree with that because I was a, if it's brown, it's down hunter. All right. And I can remember getting my first ever trail camera. It was a Moultrie. It was gigantic. I mean, it was the size of a VCR damn near, or a DVD player with little bungee strings that you would. And so at the end of the season, after they've been weathered, the bungee strings had no bungee left in them. And so it would sag. And so you had to like wrap it around the tree again to get the tightness. And they were only like a one season use. And then you'd have to order more bungee strings anyway.
Yeah.
big D batteries, you know, huge batteries that went with them, film, right? And so I went to the the farmer after I got the pictures developed, handed him the pictures, and I go, look at this buck right here. This buck is huge, right? And he goes, no, move your trail camera over to the corner of this field and then see what you have. Long story short, he was telling me, like, there's so much more out here if once you learn how to use these things, then you will see that there's bigger bucks. And of course, mm-hmm. I put it in the corner, I get the bigger buck. And so for me, when I was 26 years old, first season I ever hunted, I had a trail camera, and that trail camera told me that there were bigger deer out there, and it instantly, I went from it's brown, it's down to 4-year-olds. Like, I did not stair step up. I did not shoot a ton of spikes, right? I honestly think the smallest deer I've ever shot is like, if it had both of its, the first deer I ever shot was a half rack buck, but if it had its other side, it was a 4-year-old, probably in the 140s. And to this day, it's one of the, you know, other than a couple deformed deer that just from a measuring standpoint, they look big, but from a measuring standpoint, they're a smaller antlered deer. But outside of that, trail cameras had the largest impact for me on just telling myself, dude, if you want the biggest antlered deer, they're out there, but you have to go find them, right? And so you'd get a picture of the giant, and then what do I need to do to get this? And that led to me passing everything that was, you know, 1, 2, and 3 years old.
Yep, absolutely. And I can, you know, I haven't had a ton of opportunities when it comes to like cameras, because you know, some of the ground that I hunt, some of the private ground that I have available to me, there's not a lot of, you know, there's the landowner's like, oh, there's a huge buck out there, but you know, his idea of a huge buck is different than mine.
Right.
And, you know, and so I've gotten a few bucks on camera and stuff. And then you're kind of like, okay, well, there's some out there. And I've always relied on that property for meat. You know, I can always shoot a doe off of that property. No problem every year without a doubt. But then there was one year that I did get, you know, probably a decent 140 inch whitetail. And so then I really started hunting hard, mm-hmm. and I was spending a lot of time out there, and I ended up filling 3 doe tags in the process. So again, when you talk about the mortality rate of whitetails, you know what I mean? Like if I hadn't been out there as much as I was, I probably would have only taken the one doe that I usually take, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But I was spending so much time hunting, and just getting after it. And so exactly to your point, when you know that bigger buck is out there, you're most certainly going to spend a lot more time. You're going to be sitting all, well, hopefully you're sitting all day sits, but yeah. And then I think too,
I don't all day sit ever. I hate it, by the way. I don't like
it. It's hard. It's hard. Yeah. It's not an easy thing to do. It's probably one of the more difficult things that I've done. And then, you know, like we talked in the last podcast I did with you on Nine Finger Chronicles too, ADHD doesn't help that much.
That's right.
makes it very difficult, you know? So there's times where I've literally just climbed out of the tree and took a little nap, you know, at the base of the tree just to kind of pass a little bit of time by. And who knows, I might have been the classic, you know, painting of me sleeping, and there's a buck kind of looking over at, you know, a giant buck looking over at me from 20 yards away. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think going back to talking about technology too, I suppose, you know, scouting software is probably another big one.
Yes.
You know, having the ability to, I mean, gosh, now you can look at your stand and with some apps and see which direction the wind is at that stand location, and you know it's cool. And then at the same, you know, as long as we continue to have regulations and things like that on the number of deer that can get taken, I don't get too worried about it. But I can see too where, you know, again, going back to, I have an argument on crossbows, and there's other people that would argue against that. So you know, this, I suppose the same thing goes for technology too. It definitely gives an advantage, and whether you think that it's a moral advantage or not, I guess it's always going to be up for debate. But
yeah, Do you think that Onyx and Hunt Stand and those types of that type of technology, do you think that has led to more mature whitetails getting, or just deer or animals in general getting shot?
I don't know. That's a tough one. I guess in conjunction with trail cameras, probably. Mm-hmm. Just because now you have ways of mapping it out, you know, and seeing, you know, an overhead picture of where those bucks are kind of moving. Because, you know, I'm a visual guy, so I like to be able to see, okay, on this day he was over here, and on this day he was over here, and you can start kind of finding a pattern. So I think in conjunction with trail cameras, yes. Standalone, boy, I don't know. It's hard to say. There might be some tools or some aspects that I don't know about, you know, because there's so many different apps and so many different things coming out now that, I primarily use Onyx. And one of the things that I love about it is the, you know, the blood trailing, you know, portion of it, you know, where you find a spot of blood and you can mark it, you know, and then now all of a sudden you look and you can see that trail, which can then help you kind of lead you to find the next spot of blood if everything's getting pretty spotty. And I think all the apps have the ability to do that.
Yep.
But yeah.
Yeah. I'm obviously that type of software has led people to go in to pieces of property, especially public land, that were off the beaten trail that may not have been otherwise known as public. And so there's probably less honey holes out there now than there used to be. Mm-hmm. But I will say that what it's done is it has allowed people to feel more comfortable getting in deeper where game is living, as opposed to just 300, 400 yards off a road. Right. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I feel like it has led to more success, maybe not necessarily mature animals, but then one could argue if you do go back and you are finding deer that are animals that nobody else has been hunting.
Your little one grew 3 inches overnight. Adorable. Also expensive. Sell their pint-sized pieces on Depop and list them in minutes with no selling fees. Because somewhere, a dad refuses to pay full price for the clothes his kids will outgrow tomorrow. And he's ready to buy your son's entire wardrobe right now. Consider your future growth spurt budget secured. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
Automatically, you're going to run into more mature animals. Just because nobody's been hunting, let's say, this little area, right? And so it could have. I bet you initially it did, but now that every hunter has some type of software, especially when you're out west and you're hunting these large expanses of, unless you're a local, right, and you actually know the environment. But for me, everybody that I've ever ran out to in South Dakota or Colorado or wherever, the first thing we do is pull out our phones, say, hey, I saw a deer here. Oh, I saw an elk here. Well, I saw a mule deer here. And you share information, or antelope. Like I went to I ran into an antelope hunter. He was hunting antelope. I was hunting mule deer. And we just exchanged information based off of our map. And so that then can, those types of, that type of communication can lead to locating more game. And so, does it impact the amount of mature deer? I'm sure at some point it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you, that kind of, stirred up some thoughts in my mind too, that made me think about some other things that could attribute to, you know, larger, or I should say trophy deer hunting success, in that, you know, a couple things, because one, now these apps have provided you information to the landowner. Mm-hmm. So now you have more access to, you know, finding out who, you know, cause they may not live on that property, but now you're like, okay, I know who owns the property. I know, it just helps lead you, to maybe getting access to that property where there may be a, you know, maybe you watched a buck go off of, you know, from one piece of public into this other one, or from one piece of public into private. And then you're like, oh, so, you contact the private landowner and they give you access. So there's that,
yep.
I guess. And the other thing is too, is the biggest mule deer that I've taken out of South Dakota. I was able to pretty accurately pinpoint his location on X, mm-hmm. based on, where I was glassing him from. And so I was able to set that point. And even though I couldn't see that deer, I was probably, 3/4 of a mile away when I spotted him and ended up working my way into 40 yards and killed him. But not one time did I ever see that deer until I got to that spot,
yeah.
And just waited him out. And then when he popped up, I took the shot. So, probably wouldn't have happened without that software.
Right. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. I thought I was going to say one more thing about that, but I obviously for access, it plays a huge role. What about optics? Do you think optics plays a role, has a huge role, whether that is, and you can even break it down because a rifle is awesome, but then you put a very high quality scope on that and now you're even becoming more accurate. Right, like rifle scopes or spotting scopes or binoculars, range finders. Do you think any of those types of optics played a role in people being more successful, whether that's for mature deer or for deer in general?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. I mean, again, just having to, especially spot and stock type of stuff where, when I've been out west and having the ability to spot them from a distance, there's been times where, if you're hunting, a good example is like I've hunted opener for North Dakota and it's usually pretty hot. You don't have a lot of opportunity. You've got maybe an hour after sunrise and an hour before sunset where you're actually going to be able to spot them. You've still got leaves on the trees and stuff. So they got a lot of cover to hide in.
Yeah.
But being able to break out the spotting scope and just grid off a hillside and then just start looking and really diving into each little section of that hillside. I can't tell you how many antlers I've seen, just a little glint of an antler or a flicker of an ear,
yeah.
Just looking through a spotting scope that I never would have seen, not even with my binoculars, So having that ability to really hone in, on a small section of a hillside and just stare at it for a minute and look for movement. Yeah. Most certainly, helps to identify that there's an animal there and, then you can determine whether you're going to go in after it or not.
Yeah. And that an argument could then be made for a spotting scope or binoculars being better at acquiring game than a trail camera could be.
That's a very interesting thought.
I'll talk it out here. Obviously if I was to set a trail camera somewhere in South Dakota, wide open, way less trees, knowing how game move in some of those areas, there's probably not as many pinch points per se that these deer are moving through. They tend to travel in the same types of areas, but they're more nomadic in their movements, right? They're not like a mm-hmm. whitetail here in Iowa that's bed to feed pattern every day for 30 days, right? They're going mm-hmm. over here and then they're going over here and then they're back on the other ridge. Wind direction plays a huge role in where these deer are moving. So I would probably be able to sit on a knob and glass up a deer before I could find some type of method or area to put a trail camera that would allow me multiple pictures of these deer.
Yeah. It's a really good point that you make. And again, I guess it's an argument as to whether you want something, are you having something that's more passive that's kind of doing the work for you or,
yeah.
Again, if you have the ability to sit there and do it, most certainly, yeah. to have binoculars in your hand and be, looking for them actively. Yeah, for sure. It would be more of an advantage over a trail camera. And again, to your point too, I mean, I've heard and I've read some author or, some experts say that a mule deer will never walk past the same tree twice, which I've honestly seen that happen multiple times. So, but to that point is, yeah, they're not as patternable. You know, they're, like you said, they're more not nomadic, and they kind of wander and do their thing. So, having optics is most certainly an advantage over a trail camera, I would say.
Yeah. Any other products out there that maybe we missed and didn't talk about that have huge impacts in how hunting has evolved?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, if you look at the bow right now, you know, you could say obviously the invention of, you know, say like a drop away arrow rest, for example, or even just a springy arrow rest, is definitely an advantage over, you know, trying to bend an arrow around a riser. You know what I'm saying? So that most certainly gives you a lot more forgiveness in your ability to shoot. It definitely extends your range quite a bit, but that also goes hand in hand with all of the other technology as well. You know, the speed of the bow, the efficiency of the cams, and, you know, the strength of the riser, and, you know, just so many of those things all kind of coming together. But I think that's a big thing that I think should get some credit in that respect. And granted, I'm a little bit, you know, biased in that we have, you know, our own arrow rest as well. But, you know, like I said, it goes hand in hand with a lot of different other things. Yeah. I mean, just the materials that are put into a bowstring have come a long ways too. And so obviously that's going to be better than a catgut string that you're going to use on a traditional bow. So,
yeah. How cool would it be to be able to time travel and take your current bow setup back to the guy who's shooting the first bow and arrow ever to acquire food with it, and you guys go hunting together, and he's taking these lob shots basically at 20 yards, and you're just like, you know, like going right through them, these gigantic blood trails, you know, if you hit the lungs or the heart and things like that.
Yeah,
that would be, just to see this person's mind be blown would be something fun to see. I'm trying to think of an order now, right? I'm just going to throw out a couple random questions. Would you rather have a scope on your rifle or trail cameras? You can only pick one this upcoming hunting season. Which one are you getting rid of?
But I'm... Okay, I have so many questions because I'm hunting specific. Even if I have those trail cameras, I'm hunting with a rifle without a scope.
So
the scenario.
Yeah, so, you know, let's say you live in a state where you got one archery tag, you have one rifle tag, okay, and that's what you can hunt with in this upcoming season. You can still have your bow, you still have your rifle, but I get to take away the thing that you don't want. And you can't use it. So would you rather hunt with trail cameras or would you rather hunt with a rifle scope?
So going back to, okay, so let's say, you know, meat is not of utter importance, right? Mm-hmm. Like I don't necessarily need to have it.
Yep.
I'm going to go with the bow and the trail cameras. And I guess the reason being is, well, one, I'm a terrible shot with a gun. I don't care what optics you put on that thing. I'm missing, you know? And then two, just, I don't know, just for the fun of it, I hunted with a rifle for many years with my dad, and granted, those are great times and had a wonderful time doing that. But the first time I took a deer with a bow, it's indescribable. It's just different. There's the more visceral experience. And then also, like I was saying, with the trail cameras too, it's kind of fun. It gets you kind of hyped up. Yeah. You can share the pictures with your buddies, you know, and it adds a social element to it. And, you know, so then knowing where the deer are going to be, I'm going to go in with my bow and I'm going to make it happen that way.
Gotcha. So. Okay. Let's take a couple. So you're even going as far as picking a bow over a gun, in certain hunting scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now let's do this. Trail camera or tree stand? You got to pick, you can only pick one.
Man, I love these questions. These are
great. Or saddle. Really, or like, okay, really so tree stand or saddle. or your trail cameras?
So, and then, okay, so opposed to, okay, then I'm going to have to be on the ground.
Yep.
Oof, man, that's a tough one. Cause my first thought is, okay, you know, I'm a skilled enough hunter to hunt from the ground where I feel like if I had the trail cameras, then I know where I can sit.
Yep.
And I can in advance have a solid spot, you know, set up or, you know, put a quick natural blind up. Just knowing that I'm sitting in the right place, would be huge for me, you know, cause there's so many times where I've done some, you know, just ground and pound, right? Like you're just kind of on a whim going, boy, here's a couple of trails that look like they might be good. I think I'll set up 20 yards off of this.
Yeah.
And you could sit there for 4 days and not see anything, you know, and then you're going, okay, did I pick the right spot? Did I not pick the right spot? So, and that, you know, there's always that struggle too. Like you're just walking around, you're like looking for the tree you want to sit in and you're like, well, I don't know. I guess you get the analysis paralysis, right? Where you can't pick a spot because you're doing too much thinking, right? So just being able to narrow down and knowing, okay, I know there's deer in this area and it doesn't have to be a trophy buck. It's just, I know there's actually deer moving through this, this part of the woods. And so that's where I want to sit. I'm going to go with the trail camera on that one too.
Okay. So trail camera over tree stand, trail camera over rifle scope, trail camera versus Onyx or Hunt Stand or that type of software. And this is for your whole year. This is for your whole year. You on your Western hunts, right? You're going back in public. You can either have a trail camera for this season or you can have Onyx for this season. What are you picking?
Yeah, that was the thing that immediately went through my head just before you said that, is knowing that I would want to, you know, have the ability to go out west and use that style of hunting. I'm going to say scouting software.
You're going to choose that over trail cameras.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So trail cameras aren't as high on the list as I thought they were going to be, even though they got picked. What about, is there a product that you would just, that you could not, let's keep it to bow hunting, right? Is there a product, maybe broadhead, maybe arrow, maybe sight, maybe rest, right? Are those all wrapped into one as bow hunting, or is there certain products within bow hunting that you just could not hunt without?
Man, you know, again, it could go so many ways, but just to try to keep it broad and not try to narrow it, you know, ask you too many questions about the specifics on it. That's a good one.
I had a buddy who, when I first started shooting compound bows, okay, we would go to his backyard, and he actually did not have a sight on his bow. He had one of those little finger rests that were pretty popular back in the day, right? Just the little thing that stuck out, put your bow there. And then he had permanent marker dot lines on his riser that he put there, and you could see where they would be alcohol rubbed out and then a new one, right? So he would get the dot to start and then he'd rub it out and then he'd put that's how he shot. And he was actually pretty good using that one. I can remember my first sight was one pin from the jankiest sight ever invented, right? It looked like it was purchased at a Menards and someone put it together. It was heavy. It was made out of like stainless steel. It was horrible. But I feel like if you practice enough, you could get away with not even having a sight on your bow and be more of a feel shooter, even with a compound, than Because I feel like if you're going to judge what's more important, a sight or a rest, I feel like a rest is probably more important than a sight.
Agreed. Yeah.
On compound bows. On compound bows.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and that's where I was getting kind of hung up, because I did start to use that process of negation. Was that how you say it? Negation? Is that how you say it? Basically, a process of elimination. There
yeah.
we go.
Yeah.
And so sight was one of those things that I thought about, but then I'm like, okay, but then there's all the other things, right? So yeah. what else can I not have? You know what I mean? So, you know, I think about a release, right? And I would have to have one right now. I mean, if I didn't, I don't think I could shoot accurately. I mean, there's, I'm sure everybody's had this moment where you get in the tree and you don't have your release and you're like, what? Oh shoot, what do I do?
Yeah.
And I've had it happen a couple of times. And the only reason I didn't get out of the tree right then and there is because I didn't want to run the chance of, you know, spooking a deer, bumping a deer. But otherwise I'm pretty much just like, I'm not shooting, you know, so I'm just kicking it here in the, and I'm bird watching for the morning.
Yeah.
And so that's another one of those things where, boy, it'd be tough to live without. But like you were saying too, it's like a combination of things that, I don't think there's just one thing that I can be without. It's a combination of things that I would need to have.
Yeah. What about camo? Could you go a season without camo?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. That's for sure. That's an easy one.
I've seen more. I mean, you know, and even just like way back in the day, you know, I had another guy started a company called Pimp My Bow. And so we would just colorized bows. We basically take bows in, strip them down, take the whatever finishes on them, camo oftentimes, and we would either re-dip them in camo for some people, but we had some bows that were bright red, blue, and taking those bows out in the woods and being successful with them. And then not only that, but you just, you know, solids are becoming more popular, especially like out west and those types of situations. I don't doubt that camo does help break you up. I think there's an advantage to that when it comes to movement, but I wouldn't be too afraid to just be up in a tree in a solid, as long as I'm not sitting there with blue or yellow, I'm feeling all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this was a fun conversation, man. I really appreciate you taking, I don't know if we covered anything per se, but that's why we call these BS sessions, right? It's like, hey, dude, what would you do, man? It's like, this was a conversation that took place over the course of like a 10-hour drive somewhere, right?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, wait a second, would you really hunt without this, or would you really hunt? I will say this, going back to trail cameras, and I want to end it this way. Without trail cameras have had the biggest impact on how I hunt and what my goals are every year as far as mature whitetails. You take that away from me, I feel like my goals would be forced to be changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I have to go into properties not knowing what's there, assuming that if I pass a 3-year-old, I'm going to get a shot at a 4-year-old. There might not be any 4-year-olds there. 5-year-olds, right? Am I going to be passing 140s now, or am I going to be shooting 140s now, right?
Yeah.
And so trail cameras for me have had the biggest impact on what I chase every year, and you take that away from me and I feel like I'm a completely different hunter after that.
I would agree, and again, for me, so much of it is just part of the fun of it as well. You know, and I think, you know, one of the things is if we're looking at recruiting more hunters in some cases, and I'm kind of trying to figure that out if that's something that we really need to do or not. But, you know, because especially you get out on public land and it's like, holy cow, do we really need more hunters?
Now, where are you guys coming from?
But at the same time, you know, our business relies on that too.
Yep.
And so, again, just talking with that friend of mine and the excitement that I saw in his eyes and on his face about having the ability to see what's going on, and, you know, just knowing, you kind of create this like relationship with these animals.
Yep.
And And again, it's just, and there's so much more to it, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I even think about, you know, that whitetail, your whitetail that you got this year, you know, and just, and you were jazzed, man. You were stoked. And it's not your first rodeo.
Right.
You know what I mean? You've done this how many times, right? But just that is what's huge. And if we can, you know, if there's a tool that we can use to get more people out there and doing that, then we can also get more people on our side understanding why we do this.
Exactly.
Because I fear that, you know, we're kind of headed in a scary place where we may not have the ability to do this anymore. Yeah. And I hate that idea. I don't like, I mean, if there's so much more satisfaction in me pulling a you know, venison backstrap out of my freezer than going to the grocery store and wondering where that stuff came from. So,
so I
fear that happens. And I think the more we can educate people by getting new people involved and understand, because you just don't, you're not going to understand it unless you do it.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Well, Rick, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us a little bit.
Yeah, that was fun.
You going turkey hunting this spring?
Oh yeah.
All
yep.
Right.
I'm excited. I can't wait. It can't come soon enough. So I've already got some plans to get out and do that.
Perfect. All right, man, you have a good one. And thanks again.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. That was a lot of fun.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.